Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Rula is the world's finest magazine of cycling and cycling culture. Established in 2006, Rula interviews the world's biggest cycling names and covers the world's biggest cycling races. Visit our website at rula.cc and subscribe to support our in-depth features, long reads, independent journalism, stunning photography and immersive cycling coverage. I'm Edward Pickering, I'm the editor of Rula, and this is Rula Conversations. So we're 2 weeks into the Tour de France. It's the morning of the second rest day, and I'm catching up with James Start, who has been covering the Tour de France since the Grand Départ in Bilbao. Everyone remember that? So James has been on a race moto the last couple of stages. And I have to say, James, when I saw Pogacar's attack on the Juplan get blocked by a moto, my heart was in my mouth and I was worried it was going to be you. And I was getting ready to pretend I didn't know you.
Thanks for the solidarity. I know where I stand now. Well, it wasn't me, so we can still be friends, huh? What could I say?
We can indeed, and Rula remains blameless, yeah. And no threat of our press pass being removed for one day at the Tour de France, thankfully. But we'll discuss this later, James, because it's an interesting issue, and I know it's one that you're particularly expert on. But we do have a two-part podcast for everyone today. James and I are going to talk about the Tour de France, obviously, but we've also got a tangentially related interview with James Witts. You'll know James, he's a regular contributor to Rula. He specialises in sports science, and he decided it would be a good idea to ride the Étape du Tour last year and try to put into practice some of the things he's learned from writing about elite sports science. And he wanted to try and see if what works for a finely honed athlete at the peak of human performance also works for a regular Devonian guy who likes real ale. So we sat outside a pub in Bristol recently where I confirmed James does indeed like real ale, but also we talked about his experiences. I hesitate to use the word exploit. It's a great book called Riding with the Rocket Men. Very, very funny and also very, very educational. That's coming later. But first, James Start. Where are you and how are you?
I'm not quite sure where I'm at, to be honest, although I know I'm somewhere around the Alps. I'm about 45 minutes from Saint-Gervais in the direction of Geneva. Let's put it there.
And how are you?
How am I? I'm not sure I can answer that. I'm here. I am present and accounted for.
You must be frazzled by now. I mean, the Tour's a grueling operation for everyone, and, you know, following the race is no different. Obviously, you're not expending the same watts as the riders, but the logistics are complex as hell, aren't they?
They just get harder and harder. It's like crisis management 101 at every turn. You know, you're trying to get from one place to the next, and then you're trying to see the race, anticipate the race, reflect on the race, and write or photograph the race in a creative manner. And it does take its toll. It's physically exhausting and mentally exhausting. And yet we get a front row seat to one of the great events of the year.
Friends of mine who ask how my holiday in France is going just get a look through narrowed eyes from me. But let's talk about the race, James. You've been confidently predicting Pogacar is going to win the Tour for some weeks now. How is that looking for you?
I think on paper is the better rider by just such a small margin. But he's had two opportunities here to make a dent in the jersey, and he wasn't able to do it. One, because, you know, for sure, because of the motorcycle. Would he have gotten away? We don't know. But, you know, he lost bonus seconds. Instead of gaining, what, three or four bonus seconds on top of that climb, he lost it. And so instead of being maybe 3 seconds down going into yesterday's stage, he was 10 seconds down. And this race, you know, as we're sitting here today, this race could be the all-time closest race, less than the 8 seconds between Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon back in 1989. That could all change tomorrow. That could all change on the Col de la Luz on Wednesday. And it's really hard to say who's going to have the upper hand there. It's a really close race. I'm not teaching anybody anything here, but it's the longer I'm in it, the harder it is to tell.
Yeah. I mean, you often see over Grand Tours, well, you see many things over Grand Tours, and you can prove just about anything, but the recent trend, well, maybe the last 15 years in the Tour de France, quite often we talked about that early hammer blow that riders get in. Riders like Armstrong, you know, with his asterisks, Wiggins, Froome, Nibali, many, many Tour de France winners have struck that early hammer blow. And then they level off with the other riders, don't they? There tends to be less margin between them by the end of the race. And if that's the case here, then essentially, they seem to have fought each other to a standstill, Pogacar and Vingegaard, don't they? Because, as you said, neither can currently get a single second on the other. And, you know, it's great for the race.
It's been an amazing race. It is going to be a race for the ages. It's going down as one of the all-time greats. You know, before the race started, the tour started this year, we talked about our favorite tours in the past. You know, 89 was obviously a great one. And I mentioned that 2011, the Thomas Vogler and then the Cadel Evans race was just tremendous because it was so close and there was you never quite knew what was happening. These were all epic battles and you never knew until very close to the end who was going to pull it out. And you're not going to know until Saturday, I think, who's going to pull this one out.
And as we also talked about recently, you know, we don't decide whether it's a great Tour de France until after the race. And then, you know, even in the weeks and months after the race, you can digest the result, see the race with a bit more distance. But from my point of view, this is the tour that has so far excited me more than any since 1989, just because of the closeness. The last few days, we're seeing less of the ding-dong battle that Fignon and LeMond had. You know, each was gaining 20, 30 seconds a time, and they were alternating good and bad days. Much tighter and more tense and, in a way, more absorbing between Pogacar and Vingegaard. But it's so close, I cannot say who I think will win because, like I say, we've got three very, very hard stages and very important stages to come. How's the atmosphere on the Tour? There must be a sense of building excitement in the race. The Tour de France is a bubble, and everything that happens in that bubble is magnified and you feel it more intensely. So how's the atmosphere in the race about this close battle?
I think this race is an exception to the rule. I think this is a race where we know already it's going to be one for the ages just because of everything that's happened. At this point, if one of them does finally do that knockout punch, it's still been such a great race just to get to this point. And everybody I talk to in that bubble is saying, wow, this has been an amazing race. The parcours is amazing, but then you can have an amazing parcours, you can have an amazing race route, but then you have to have the actors to step up on that stage and play the leading roles. And we've had two stellar leading players here, and they have put in, right up to this point, just one of the great performances I've ever seen. And that seems to be the word here at the Tour.
I agree with that, actually. At the Giro d'Italia this year, that battle between Roglic and Geraint Thomas was very close, but it was very quite cool. It felt like both were trying not to lose the Giro for most of it, and there wasn't that sense of a, you know, either going out to win it until that very end when Roglic very well did. This time, Pogacar's gone looking for it. And that reflects the worldviews, personalities and riding styles of the two protagonists, because the fact that they're so different, Vingegaard's very icy, very cool, very defensive in his racing style, whereas Pogacar is mercurial, aggressive, extroverted. And I think that also raises the battle between the two.
I can't say enough about both of them. They both just put it on the line in different ways, but they both do it without hesitation. And they're not the only ones. Matthew Vanderpool's been going out in the breaks every day trying to get something. Wout van Aert had his chance yesterday. And this generation of riders, they just lay it down. And they're both doing it. Pogacar does it in, yeah, like you said, more mercurial. He'll go on these blitzing attacks. But Vingegaard takes that whole team and just throws the gauntlet down from kilometer zero, putting the team at risk, putting him at risk. And he's not afraid to do it. And he's going for these sprints too. I mean, they're going for it at the top of these climbs and seeing if they can claw back 3 seconds here, 2 seconds there. And nobody's giving an inch. And they've both just thrown in the kitchen sink here. I mean, it's a massive battle.
The funny thing is, normally I'm not a huge fan of bonus seconds in Grand Tours, though, you know, it is part of the race. Everyone knows the rules. When you get a race with bonus seconds, such as Vuelta a couple of times in recent years, where the best rider is also winning the bonus seconds, like it's been Roglic, it makes it very hard for anyone to make a dent in that. Why I think it's worked particularly in this tour, however, is that, you know, Vingegaard does have that lead. Pogacar does have the assets to chip away using bonus seconds. And you know, the bonus seconds are actually really magnified in their importance in the way that I've not seen in the Tour de France for many years. That could be the difference between the two.
Well, absolutely. I talked to Thierry Gouvenou, who is the race director here and works with Christian Prudhomme to come up with a race course every year. And we did a feature on this early in the race on Rouleur. And one of his big contributions, he's very proud of it, is using those bonus seconds and also where he puts that final climb of the day, finding climbs in any part of the country and deciding, okay, is this one I'm going to go at the end of the stage, which could hand the race over to the punchers or give the GC guys a chance, or he's going to put it earlier or midway through the stage so that the sprinters can potentially regroup and come first. But I'm not talking about like the huge mountain stages. I'm just talking about every stage or climb. The final climb has bonus seconds. That's been part of his formula in recent years to give the potential for what we're seeing this year, to explode that sort of monotony when one team dominates too much. And it's working. Will it work next year? We don't know, but it serves working this year. It's sort of like back in 1989 with that final time trial on the Champs-Élysées. It was brilliant. It was like, oh my God, why don't we do this every year? Well, because a lot of years, you know, the race could be already wrapped up and it doesn't really matter. And you're not going to get the same sort of thing. That year turned out to be the perfect spot on year for that to happen. And this is a year where these bonus seconds are getting magnified, are playing such a role. I think it's exciting.
I've been getting really into the bonus seconds maths, actually, James. The interesting thing is you can apply game theory to this, because the bonus seconds at stage finishes are 10, 6 and 4 for first, second and third. And the little nuance about that, which normally no one would care about, is that when first beats second, there's a 4 second difference. And then when second beats third, there's a 2 second difference. And from third to fourth, there's a 4 second difference again. So there is an advantage to finishing third on the stage for Pogacar ahead of finishing second, assuming that Vingegaard's right behind him, which is crazy, really, because there should be increasing rewards for the higher up you get. So there was that situation in Morzine off the Juplan where there was Pogacar's teammate Adam Yates, Pogacar and Vingegaard going into Morzine. Carlos Rodriguez had the stage wrapped up, so he was going to get the 10 seconds. If Pogacar had had the presence of mind, or anyone in the team car had the presence of mind, which is easy to say in retrospect because I didn't really think of this at the time, they should have sent Adam Yates ahead to get the second place, 6 seconds, and then Pogacar outsprints Vingegaard for 4, because the difference there was that if Pogacar had outsprinted Vingegaard for third, he would have gained an extra 2 seconds. Maybe overthinking it, James, but then again, in a tour where the margin is currently 10 seconds after 2 weeks, maybe I'm not, but that's how important the bonus seconds are this year.
Well, you mentioned this in one of your stories, and I thought it was brilliant analysis, actually, and it would have been really interesting. Although, you know, I think that Pogacar was a bit shook up with the motorcycle incident that day. Vingegaard, I don't think on paper, would have won that sprint at the top of the mountain. He looked to me a little bit confused, and I think maybe forgot that there was actually bonus seconds there. I don't know what happened, but I don't think they were as lucid as they could be there, because there was just, there had been so much chaos. I mean, there was that mass crash in the beginning. Let's not forget. I mean, that was a chaotic day on the roads. And the fans are so incredibly dense as well. I mean, it's constant chaos. So I will forgive them for not getting their maths right in the final kilometer.
Yeah, so easy for me sitting on the comfort of my sofa thinking about numbers. I was going to say, let's zoom out a bit. The middle week of the tour, James, there's been a real variety of stages and methodology in winning the stages. We had Peo Bilbao winning in Issoire from a small group, and that was a real interesting day, really lumpy day, very hot day, and came down to a really political, tactical situation at the end with Bilbao winning, but not an easy one to engineer. Enjoyed that one. We had Jasper Philipsen winning a bunch sprint, regular bunch sprint in Moulin. Probably the most normal, quiet, average stage of the tour, except for me, because I used to live in Moulin and I love the town dearly. Jon Izagirre won on his own in Belleville. He won from that break in a different way than Bilbao won his stage in Issoire. He went solo from a long way out and just rode alone to the line. We had Michał Kwiatkowski won on the Grand Colombier, which was the beginning of Ineos rescuing their Tour de France, because up to that stage, they had nothing, absolutely nothing from this tour. And from that stage and the next one where Carlos Rodriguez won in Morzine, they suddenly had two stage wins. They're up there in the team classification and Rodriguez is hanging around third overall. And then finally yesterday, we had Wout Poels winning in Saint-Gervais from a long, long break. Best climber in that break, engineered it well. And then in amongst all that, we've had the GC battle. So I've really enjoyed this second week.
It's been an amazing week, as was the first. And, you just gave us a whole lot of break situations. I didn't really realize there was so many breaks that actually made it, because the GC guys have been just driving it and keeping it together on some stages where we expected breaks to go away. Every one of those guys who won those breaks, anybody who made those breaks is flying, because to get in most of those breaks, it was like a 2-hour battle. I mean, it was just nonstop attacking until a break could finally form that got away. I mean, it has been a brutal couple of weeks of racing. To make those breaks, you got to be really good.
Yeah, I think it was the Belleville stage. I get a bit nerdy at the start of stages, James, and sometimes on those punchy days, I count how many attacks there have been for the break to go away. And only count tacks off the front, like counters and stuff, it gets a bit complicated, but I made it 50. 50 attempts before the break actually went, which is just crazy, crazy hard. And I don't know how riders judge that this is the right move. I think it's a matter of luck and circumstance as much as the legs, but that's part of the entertainment of the tour. So overall, James, I mean, obviously UAE Jumbo having great tours, and one of those two teams and one of their leaders is going to win it. Who else is looking happy and who else is looking glum from your view on the ground?
Sudal, Quickstep, has not been having a good race. They lost their key sprinter, Jakobsen, and he got caught up in that, I think it was a stage 3 or 4 crash. And, it's just been battered and bruised and was just doing everything he could to finish every stage. Not having a good one. Lotto, Destiny also lost to Caleb. So they've been suffering tons. But then you have these other teams like De Koenig and with Philipsen and Vanderpool just putting on, I look forward to the sprint stages right now because they've been so exciting. And okay, yeah, he's the best right now. He's clearly the fastest, but the way they turn it around, the lead out by Vanderpool and then Philipsen closing, has just been really, really exciting. And in terms of teams that are still struggling to find their place, Groupama also. Goudou was hoping for the podium and he's struggling to stay in the top 10. He's not having a great tour and it's compromised the team's ability to express itself as well as we'd like. Movistar has struggled since they lost Mas. They've lost two riders now. I mean, it's a brutal race. And, there are three teams that are just shining. There is UAE and Jumbo on the GC thing. And then obviously De Koenig with the Philipsen. And then there's the rest. I think Ineos has done tremendously to come back, bounce back and get in this race and being on the podium with a young up and coming rider is very exciting. Seeing Kwiatkowski win again is always tremendous. He's, such a great pro and such an experienced pro. But there's a lot of teams that, are really struggling even to exist in this race.
Yeah, time's running out as well. You often find, you know, you don't learn much in the third week that you haven't found out already in the first two. But let's talk motos, James. There was the incident at the top of the Col de Juplan where Vingegaard had chased down Pogacar. Pogacar launched an attack with maybe 500 to go to the top, but was balked by the motos, which in turn had been balked by the crowds. And it took the wind out of his sails. You could see it. And there was a lot of criticism. The photographer and his driver were off the race for a day. I think it was Bernard Papon from L'Équipe. And I have to point out, he did take one of my favourite photos of the entire tour so far, just afterwards, which was Vingegaard sprinting for the top and Pogacar trying to close him down, which the expressions on their faces were, yeah, you can't make up that kind of expression. But what's your perspective on this? You are more of an expert on this than me or most of the listeners of Relo Conversations.
I was actually putting pen to paper before our podcast, trying to break it down and show readers what happens, what we're out there doing in the motos and how it works. Bernard Papon is a friend of mine, and he is a master of doing what he did there, shooting right there at that moment. And his driver is one of the best. And the French television moto driver and cameraman are some of the best. But they got caught. I think they both underestimated just how fast Pogacar can attack and were just too close. Obviously, the crowds were so dense. So there's twice as many photo motos in the Tour de France as in any other race. Okay, and most of the day, it works this way. We're all, like, say we're going into a climb, like the Juplan, and we all want to be photographing, get that shot of Pogacar and Vingegaard, you know, lined up against each other. And we all are all stacked up in a single file line ahead of the race on the right-hand side of the road. The Tour has two moto regulators, they call them, and their job is to basically create a sense of order, so that we're not all trying to drop back and shoot the same time. So we're all lined up against the head regulateur. And when he gives you permission, the last moto in line drops down to the first regulateur, who then is directing a group of maybe three of us. So one moto is allowed to finally drop down next to the TV cameras and shoot. And then there's two others that are waiting, and they're slowly getting in position. And when that moto comes up, the next closest in line drops down. And you get about 30 seconds to shoot, and then you got to go all the way back up the top of the line. That whole process will take you easily 2 to 3 kilometers to get 30 seconds to shoot. It creates a sense of order. It can be frustrating because you don't get, you see a shot coming. How many times have I come up, my turn comes up, and we go into a turn and come back, and the light is like not what it was. It was like perfect, and all of a sudden it's totally backlit and blown out. This just happens all the time. But you just have to accept what it is, because this is the Tour and everybody gets their turn. And it works more or less. It's been working very well. That day, actually, I thought it was working tremendously. I even said, you know, these crowds were intense, and despite the crowds, we were all able to work. Now, that said, I anticipated that it was going to get really complicated close to the top. And I wanted to have the time to get off my bike and try to find a shot and set it up and just go for getting one shot. The other thing that's important to understand here is that when you get into the densest crowds, once you start to have attacks, they instantly put into place, or very often put into place, what they call the pool. And the pool photographer, there's one at the back and there's one at the front. And Papon is the pool photographer at the front. Any picture he takes during that point in time where a pool has been called, he must share with everybody. His job at that point is to provide images for everybody that's on a moto so they can distribute it with their agencies around the world. And it's obviously in the Tour's interest to get as many pictures distributed around the world. The idea of putting in place that pool is that you eliminate that whole section of photographers trying to wait their turn and getting impatient or whatever. You just take 10 motos out of the race, put them anywhere but close to the race, and you just have one guy focusing on getting those images. That's where we were at. We are at the most locked down situation in the race. We had the television camera, whose job is to diffuse images around the world, and the one single moto left in the race who has to share his images with everybody. So it was at the moment where the rules were the strictest and there was the least amount of room for error, and yet error happened. Why? You know, you never quite know. I wasn't inside, but the crowds were the crowds this year have been so dense. And on Juplan, they were as thick as I'd ever seen. I came around a corner Now I'm 5 feet, I'm 5K from the bottom. It was almost my turn. I was just in front of that regulator who's going to tell me, now it's your turn. We come around a hairpin and a dad steps out with a kid holding his hand right in front of the regulator's moto. I mean, the guy, there was not an accident right there, was amazing. Just yesterday, I was miles ahead. They were trying to get ahead of the race. I was driving with my moto driver and a police gendarme, and we were wide open road. All of a sudden, a teenager rolls out on his mountain bike, just not even thinking. These are the accidents waiting to happen every moment that we're constantly avoiding. So Papon is in the middle of one of the densest crowds we've ever seen. If he gets too far ahead of that race, they're going to jump in and he's not going to have a picture. I'm sure that's what both of them were thinking, the television camera and him. So they're trying to maintain an option. And if my memory serves me, it was just before they had some ropes set up that held the fans back. So I'm saying they're about 600 meters because those ropes started at 500 meters. So it was at the last most dense part of the race where Pogacar attacked and where those guys got caught out. It's an accident. It's their fault, but it's what we would call a fait de course. You know, it's one of those things. You see these things happen every once in a while and you go, why don't they happen more often? The crowd accidents, kids stepping out, bikes rolling out. It's amazing there's not more accidents. Considering the amount of risk and the potential for disaster, these things happen pretty rarely.
The paradox is, of course, that the sport loves those images. There's nothing better, more intense, that expresses the beauty of cycling more than those pictures of crowds in on the riders in the mountains. That is the essence. That is what we use to market the sport. That is what the sport uses to market the sport. At the same time, that line between the outside world and the cycling world is a really blurred one, isn't it? So is there a solution to this, James? Is there a better way of doing it so that instances like that which happened on the Juplan don't happen more often? Or is it a case of accepting the rarity of that in exchange for the intensity of that fan experience?
I don't think there's a solution. I mean, what are your solutions? Ban the fans? We already saw that happening in COVID. That didn't go over very well. I mean, the fact that the fans couldn't go up to Puy-de-Dôme. I mean, even Pogacar told me when we sat down for our interview with the magazine in April, he goes, Puy-de-Dôme's going to be special, but the fact that there's not going to be any fans, it's like there's going to be something missing. A lot of riders feed off these fans as well. And yes, that hysteria, when you can capture it in a camera or on film, on television, is what gives the tour its majesty. And, you know, the second solution, more barriers. But then you got barriers. And then it's just like having no fans. I'm sorry. It's the same thing. Actually, you know, they have just little ropes. And then, you know, gendarmes placed along the roads. And that, as soon as they got into the ropes, it was a different ball game. So that wasn't bad. I think you have to take every precaution for it not to happen. The motos need to be constantly aware, and we're constantly being reprimanded. We're constantly being reminded of, you know, this, that, potential risks. I mean, it's all the time. And I think that generally, you know, we don't see a lot of these things happening, especially in a race like the Tour de France. So generally, you know, I think they get pretty high marks on that. And also, I mean, look at the two riders concerned, Vingegaard and Pogacar. Neither of them was crying or complaining. I mean, yeah, they were frustrated. But neither said, oh, scandal, huh? That wasn't happening. Personally, I thought the jury should have considered taking away the points from that. That climb on that day with that situation, if the situation was grave enough that you're going to fine and exclude drivers and photographers and cameramen, then maybe you should consider neutralizing the points given, because that sprint was clearly affected by that, what happened there. But outside of that, you know, what more can you really do? I really don't know.
Yeah, no, it's a very nuanced view of a very complex subject, James. Thanks for that. What's upcoming for you in the next few days?
Well, we got this time trial. I think it's only like 20K, and we go up the famous wall of a climb called the Côte de Domancy, where Bernard Hinault, you know, won the world championships. And it's actually called Rue Bernard Hinault at the top. We've had this TT in the race about five, 6 years ago, I believe, 5 years ago. It's going to be really interesting, and it's really hard for me to say who's got the advantage on this brutal 2 kilometer climb. You know, Pogacar's got the punch, but 2 kilometers at that grade, you have to sustain that. And, you know, I was reading in L'Equipe, Pogacar says he thinks there's going to be a big time gap on this TT. At the same time, I could see it being, you know, 2 seconds.
Thank you, James. We're going to take a short break, and then I'll be back with James Witt to talk largely about pain and suffering. This episode of Roulin Conversations is brought to you by GCN+. The Tours de France are here. They're the greatest races in the world, and you can see every unmissable moment on GCN+. I'm not actually going out for much of the Tours this year, so I'm really looking forward to being able to watch every stage from start to finish, ad-free. And for those days where life gets in the way of a cycling fan's real priorities, I can catch up at any time, because there are full replays of both races on demand. For the really busy, there is a selection of tailored highlights packages. You can go for long, short, or just the final kilometres. And as a cycling journalist, one of the most useful features is the ability to pause and rewind the live coverage. And this feature is great for trying to work out what's happened and why. You can also take the action with you if you're out and about. You can watch GCN Plus on any device. GCN Plus have brilliant commentators and co-commentators and an expert panel of knowledgeable ex-pros who will dissect and analyse the action, but also convey the fun and passion of the Tours. And you can relive the best moments and biggest talking points on the weekly World of Cycling show, and this airs throughout the season. If that's not enough, you can get all the pre-race information you need with previews, route maps, profiles and start lists all available on the GCN app. With GCN Plus, the coverage continues all year round, with coverage of all the biggest races from the road, cyclocross, track and MTB seasons. You'll also have access to a huge collection of exclusive cycling films covering all aspects of the sport, from chats with legends through epic adventures to record-breaking challenges. There are already 150 titles, with more being added every week. A GCN subscription costs as little as the price of a cup of coffee a month, and all our listeners can get 15% off an annual GCN Plus subscription. Head to gcn.eu/ruler15 to subscribe and save 15%. This episode of Ruler Conversations is also brought to you by BMC. At Ruler, we've been listening to a few other great cycling pods, and we want to share one of our favourites with you. The Riders Digest, powered by BMC, takes you into the world of bikes with unparalleled access to everything. From getting inside the World Tour and Mountain Bike World Cups through to on-the-ground access at some of the biggest events. They also take deep dives into industry secrets and cutting-edge bike tech. Champion riders like Fabian Cancellara, Cadel Evans and Greg Van Avermaet are familiar voices on the pod, and they're mixed in with next-level sound design to bring you right into the visceral world of cycling. If you want to experience a different perspective on the cycling world, then search for the Riders Digest wherever you get your podcasts or hit the link in our show notes. And now, back to Roulin Conversations. I'm with James Witts, cycling journalist, sports science expert, occasional contributor to Roulin, and now the author of Riding with the Rocketmen, One Man's Journey on the Shoulders of Cycling Giants, which is out now, published by Bloomsbury. We're at a very windy outdoors table at the Barley Mow pub in Bristol. Welcome to Roulin Conversations, James.
Thank you very much for your time on this, rather gusty afternoon.
Riding with the Rocketmen tells the story of James's somewhat rash decision to participate in the 2022 Étape du Tour. The route was what some cycling journalists call the Alpine Circle of Death. James is laughing at me here. It was. It went from Briançon up the Col du Lautaret, thence to the Col du Glébier, onto the Col de la Croix de Fer, and finally up Alpe d'Huez. The book is packed full of useful advice, such as always wear your best boxer shorts to any physiological testing. James, your speciality is sports science, so you've tapped into your contact book for advice on how you could better survive the ordeal. You've outlined a few of the marginal gains used by World Tour pros, and you kind of applied them to, well, the everyman who plays five-a-side football on a Monday night and likes craft beer. So first question is really, James, what on earth were you thinking?
Well, I guess a midlife crisis. I mean, I don't know what midlife is, 45. I mean,
definitely.
About 35.
50, thank you very much.
50. You don't look a day over 49, Edward. Yeah, well, my background, as you say, is sort of cycling journalism and stroke sport science. That was my degree, stroke English, many years ago. And I'd spent a lot of time with the teams. And I really enjoy that aspect, unearthing like how they, these supermen are honed and molded into finely sort of honed athletes. And then I had the stupid thought of like, well, okay, I've done a couple books in the past, the Science of the Tour de France, followed by a football one, which was similarly styled. So I spent time with Man United, Liverpool, Barcelona, just seeing what goes on in the back rooms. And I thought, well, this is great, but what about applying some of these ideas to my aging, slowly beerified body? Just the year by year, I think the ale had clung on a little bit. The idea was twofold, really. I thought, well, let's aim for a big goal for me. I've done quite a few endurance events, but certainly not mountainous. And historically, to be honest, more running. And what I thought was run speed, which probably never was run speed, never actually transcended into cycling speed. So I thought I was very good at the theory, but not the application. So yeah, the idea really was for me to spend time with my contacts, see what they do. And then that would be the start of each chapter, the first half. And then the second half would be me applying these techniques to my body, whether it was altitude training and nutrition, etc., etc.
Yeah. So build a bit more of the foundation. What was your interest in sports science originally? Where did that come from? Because a degree in English and sports science, I mean, at least you've ended up in the right job.
Well, exactly.
Where did you first get the interest from?
Where did it come from? Well, actually, I on a real basic level, I enjoyed reading and I enjoyed sport. I do remember, in fact, probably near your way, I remember my work experience with the Express and Echo, and I spent it at Exeter City, actually.
I should just say, we're both from Exeter, aren't we?
Yes.
So the Express and Echo is Exeter's local newspaper.
Exeter's, albeit probably dying local newspaper, unfortunately. So, yeah, I certainly had an interest there. The sports science side, again, I remember seeing this programme on TV. I think it was not Superstars, but again, it went into the background of like how swimmers were formed and all the physiology behind it. And I don't know, for some reason, I had a real interest in that. And football was my background. And as I say in the book, I had a trial for Watford. As it turns out, a lot of players in the Southwest youngsters had a, but I guess in a way it was sort of a failed sportsmanish, but I guess that was the start of it. So that's where I did the sport in English. Yeah.
And then cycling.
And then cycling. Well, cycling, so, you know, like many people, I've always cycled, but professionally I used to edit a triathlon magazine, sort of 220. I did that for a fair few years. But I was fascinated by, I guess, the professional side more. I mean, cycling's such a fascinating sport. On one level, it looks so simple, isn't it? And then obviously, you scratch a little deeper, it's like, well, hang on, that bloke came down halfway and he's winning. how does that work? So the complexities of that really appealed. So that's when I went freelance on a professional basis, about 10 years ago now. So I pushed the cycling side. And I pushed the sports science side because I saw a bit of a gap there, which probably evolved around the same time Marginal Gains was hitting the, and, you know, suddenly all these cyclists with power meters and taking blood tests and not injecting drugs. Obviously, recreational riders would never do that unless you read the book. But so, yeah, it's sort of just building blocks, really. But actually transfer it to myself. Again, I'm by no means a really good cyclist or a good cyclist. But I feel there is a gap in road cycling for people probably like myself who've got a real interest in it, but probably not that committed enough to like every Sunday go out for a 5-hour ride and have 10% body fat. So I guess that everymanish appeal I was trying to aim for.
So what was your aim in riding the Étape du Tour?
My aim, let's be honest, it was completion. Time-wise, I was hoping really for around 10 hours, just under. As you said, the course was, it was about 100 miles, 170K, but 5,000 meters of climbing. Now, obviously the specimen that sits in front of you now, Ed, is, it's no Quintana. You know, I'm what, 6'2", 6'3". Now I'm probably back to about 14, getting towards 14.5 stone, and that was probably my starting point. So I didn't have concerns over the distance, but the mountains were like, no, that's going to be hard work. So I thought, well, that's the real challenge. And the heat. And let's be honest, from a drama side or trying to appeal, having the goal event as a stage of the Tour de France is quite a big hit rather than maybe a hill climbing event up north. No disrespect to a hill climbing event up north.
So what did your training consist of?
Well, I had a 6-month plan. This was via Training Peaks and a very nice chap called Phil Mosley, cycling coach, but does triathlon as well. So Phil set me up on a plan. Most of it, I had a watt bike, so it was very much power-based, and a lot of it was indoors. As I say in the book, unfortunately, I'd had a bike fit right at the start of the process with Phil Burt. I'm sure a lot of your readers will be aware of Phil, who used to work with Team Sky and now has got a clinic up at Manchester. He measured me, got me in my optimum position, a comfort position, let's be honest, rather than too aerodynamic a position. And then I had 4 bikes stolen about the week after. So that set me back for a couple months. So it was very watt bike heavy for the first 6 weeks. But I spent a lot of time watt bike, but then it was the traditional, probably again, as listeners would probably follow themselves, a long ride, increasingly long ride on a Sunday, usually 3 weeks increase in volume, 1 week rest, so reel it back slightly. And then from week 5, for example, you roughly take off from week 3 and just build it up over 24 weeks, I think. So that was the basics of the training plan. But the second strand to it was, although I was aiming for the etap, I wanted, again, just to take it a step further, which I thought would be more of interest, at least to me, so I have a real diluted pro calendar. So I wanted to do a cyclocross a la Pidcock, etc., time trial, and a Northern European sort of cobbled classic. So cyclocross event, yeah, Flanders Sportif, and a time trial in Dursley, Gloucestershire. So it was all sort of thrown in, really.
And one of the challenges, obviously, and it's a challenge for all of us who do a bit of sport on the side around a full-time job, maybe a family as well, and other commitments in life, you know, having a training program around that is quite hard to build in. So what did your normal week look like?
Well, it wasn't too bad, because actually I'd said to Phil at the start, I didn't want, as much as I could, I didn't want it to completely dominate. Like you said, you know, we've got 2 children, albeit a bit older now, but they were both living with us at the time. We were moving house. My wife had been diagnosed with long COVID. So there was quite a lot thrown into the mix. So I didn't really want to do more than a peak over like 10, maybe 12 hours a week. So I had a long run ride on a Sunday, and then it was probably 3 rides in the week of working at different zones, but not really much more than an hour, hour and a half. It would vary. It might be a maintenance effort, 40 minutes, sub-threshold, just above threshold. So in the week was fine, but then I was adamant. My background was football, and I love playing five-a-side football on a Monday night. And unless I really had to, I didn't want to give that up, because, you know, I still think I'm Brian Robson. But sadly,
for our younger listeners, Brian Robson was a famous footballer in the 1980s.
He was, and is God. But yeah, so I didn't want to give that up on a Monday night. And actually, I also thought it's really tiring. It's 70 minutes, really a interval session. You know, I know you run as well. So it was a real, like, so that was in a way key to it as well. So it's probably 4 bikes a week, football, and I was commuting at times as well. But it was manageable. I wasn't waking up every morning thinking, I can't do my job today.
Yeah. So a lot of the book is also a result of your research and work and interviews around the World Tour and professional cyclists. You talk a lot about the pros and explain why they're so good. And Tadej Pogačar, I've learned, has great glycolytic capacity. So
it's easy for you to say.
It's very, very difficult to say. It's quite difficult to understand as well. So did this journey you've been on kind of underline what the difference is between the rest of us and the World Tour pros?
Yes. Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was with, if I can pronounce his name correctly, an ego, Sam Milan, who he's been in cycling for years and years. And He coaches Pogacar. He does a lot of research with mitochondria and cancer. He really knows his stuff. So, in that case, in short, he's just got incredible capacity to recover and also incredible capacity to race fast while using fats rather than carbs. So carbs are limited in the body compared to even the thinnest rider has got a hell of a lot of calories stored in fat. That seems to be his sort of natural advantage. But yeah, it just hammered home, I think, that support side. And you know, you've been in the sport a long time, just that monitoring, which they've got, as an aside, I think they've got to be careful with, because it's probably quite oppressive at times. Interestingly, interviewed Trek Segafredo's sports psychologist Elisabetta Borgia, who was saying they're very mindful of overloading, I guess analysis by paralysis of just too much and too much pressure. But yeah, they are so monitored, you know. And interestingly, I don't know if you've heard of like performance plates, so really measuring portion size, which on one hand you think, wow, that seems dangerous in a way. But actually, some of the nutrition was saying, well, the riders quite like that, because I think what seems to make these riders so good, or one of the strands, is just pure efficiency. That's a decision they don't have to make. And I think, it was Owen Blandy, maybe, the EF nutritionist, was saying that, yeah, some of the riders, he thinks they're so efficient, just everything's the same. So it might be, yeah, I'll have a 2-egg omelette. They won't change at all. They'll be the last one down to the foyer before they go the transfer to the start. And it's sort of just standard stuff. But yeah, they're just different beasts.
Now, the thing is, though, you mentioned that the measuring of everything. And obviously, the World Tour professionals have got the support and the time to measure everything. And it's in their benefit. Marginal gains has become such a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. And the more you measure and the more you know, the more knowledge you have. And you talked about a few different things you can do to measure. You wore a glucose monitor, your blood tested. And you know, you don't have to do these things, do you? But at the same time, if you have access to it and you can do it and you feel it be beneficial, then you can learn a lot from measuring all these different things.
Yeah, and I think now it's reached a stage where the generation coming through, that's sort of the norm. You know, I think for one of that's more indigenous now, that they've just grown up with all of these metrics. I mean, whereas obviously maybe the older riders probably took a bit of convincing, as you know, it does with older folk, like new ideas. But yeah, I think it's such fine margins. Although interestingly, after it all, I think one of the biggest things that jumped out is one of the most hardest things to measure is just the mind and that motivation and the need to succeed, which there's questionnaires and bits and pieces, but I think it's still very hard to measure that aspect of how hard do you want it or how hard do you need it, which arguably, you know, obviously Lance Armstrong was probably a bit naughty at times, but
well, probably he's doing some heavy lifting there, James. It's right, you can, you know, be clear about it.
Okay, yes, he was a cheating devil, but you know, he clearly had a will to succeed that transcended any, well, not maybe transcended, but you couldn't buy that in a chemist. You know, he obviously had a slightly psychopathic will to succeed, but and cross the line. But obviously, to be at that level, you've got to have a real either need to achieve or need to avoid failure. But
I mean, it wouldn't be a cycling book without a section on doping, I guess. Stories like Lance Armstrong's and the DCMS report into Dr. Richard Freeman and Team Sky, they're all a matter of public record. And you've spoken to a few experts who, you know, all are pretty unanimous in saying that cycling has considerably cleaned up its act. You know, no one would be naive enough to say that cycling is a clean sport 100%, but considerably cleaner than it was even 10 or 12 years ago. But you also spoke to Joe Papp, a former professional cyclist and somebody who actually dealt in performance enhancing drugs as well. He said that 80% of his clients were not professional cyclists but competitive amateur cyclists. And I don't mean by that the guys who are just under the world tour. It's people like A-type personalities who do it as a recreational pursuit.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But not you. I'm not casting aspersions at you here, by the way, James.
Well, if I was on the med, they clearly didn't work, unfortunately. But yeah, and that was fascinating because I spoke to Joe, who's you know, he's almost evangelical, I think, these days of what happened. And I mean, Joey, he sent me so much material. I had like prescriptions of like mid-2000s to doctors in the Middle East. I was like, I mean, maybe understandably Bloomsbury didn't want to publish them. But yeah, he was saying such a high percentage were, like you said, probably that A-type personality, you know, front of the pack at the Grand Fondos and sportives. Obviously, it's not ideal to dope. I get it as a professional rider, especially in an era where you are either in a team or not, and your livelihood depends on it, and that's been your dream since you were at school. You know, I don't think you can particularly just demonise that quite human, you know.
Yeah, I guess there's a cultural pressure, and you know, it's out of people. It becomes almost not a personal decision. You know, it obviously is a personal decision, but you can understand the context and the nuance of it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you could see there's a tangible reward, I guess. But for recreational, as well, there's, you might win 50 quid and a bottle of energy drink or something. So it's like, well, what was the driver there? But Joe was saying that actually, arguably, a greater motivator beyond money is the ego and pride. And I guess if your, you know, drive is to succeed, I also think there's probably an element of, if you're that dedicated to it, there might be that fascination with, well, how much quicker will that make me? Clearly, I'm not condoning you know, the use of... But there was a study, I think I'd mentioned in the book, about people's take on supplements, and there seemed to be a bit of a link there. For them, it didn't seem much of a jump between taking a lot of supplements and vitamins and then something that was on the wilder list.
So you opted against performance-enhancing drugs, but what are the most beneficial strategies and the easy wins, really, for improving? So if anyone who's listening to this fancies having a crack at the Etappe Tour, a bit late for this year, it's happening in about a month's time, but in the future, you know, you've got 6 months to train. What are the really easy wins and the most beneficial things you can do, because when you don't need the absolute minute marginal gains, such as measuring glucose?
Well, I'd say... this sounds an obvious one, but I think it's all got to start from the motivation for that challenge. Now, I know on like the morning of the Etappe, and as I go into probably a bit too much detail at times, I wasn't very well overnight before the race. And actually, if it wasn't for the book, I don't think I would have even raced. But I was like, there's not a great end, and Bloomsbury might not not be overly happy if the end point is... yeah, and I just retired at the hotel. But so I think that motivation to whatever the challenge is has clearly got to be there from the start. And then I guess that is the working back aspect. For me, that training plan, like I said, I've done a lot of events in the past, running, triathlon, cycling, but level cycling, but not particularly too regimented a training plan. Having that training plan, I felt really helped. It made me feel more accountable. And it also helped that, I mean, we're here outside this rather nice pub now, Ed, having a nice pint of Bristol Brewery's finest. But the bit that really helped when I lost probably about 5K by the start line, which didn't sound a lot, like I said, but I feel anything would have helped. But I had two spells where I just cut alcohol completely. So it was about 9 weeks out of the 24. That was ironically the only times I really noticed the loss of weight. But I think having the training plan, doing that, it all sort of building blocks to that accountability. Bike fit, I mentioned that quite a bit in the writings I've done before, but I think that does really help, because it didn't take a lot for you to be slightly off and your knees not aligned and injury to strike, and get people on board, really. Like my wife was, I mean, to be fair, she was struggling with long COVID, but she was supportive from the sofa. But I think the biggest one is you got to be motivated enough to do it, and then also take it well. I guess that was part of the joy of the book, really, was trying to learn from the pros. So if you're racing in the heat, you know, do a bit of heat acclimation work, sort of take it seriously, but don't let it kill your life. I guess you don't want it to become not fun if you can avoid it.
Yeah, I guess it's meant to be fun, isn't it? Even though, you know, on the face of it, riding 5,000 vertical meters on a very hot day when your training context is the West Country of England, which is neither particularly mountainous nor particularly hot.
Yeah.
So, you know, that makes training for that specific effort quite hard, but at the same time, it does have to be fun, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you've got to cling on to that. And another thing I would say is, in a way, I probably enjoyed when did the Flanders Sportif more than the Etape. Again, for anyone who will enjoy the joy that is that book, the Etape, I did it solo, went on my own, wasn't overly well, but the logistics of it all being a point to point, I'd signed up too late, or there was a shuttle bus to take you from the end point on the Saturday back to the start line. That was full, so I had to work out a bus route, and my French is poor at best. So Flanders I did with some mates, and actually I would recommend that. I felt a lot more stressed having a tap. Part of that is I didn't have anyone to particularly vent any disorganized chaos that I managed to throw on the situation.
Yeah. And the Flanders Sportif, you've got a choice of distances, and yeah, obviously it's tough because you're riding quite a long way, probably in chilly weather, and there are many hills. They aren't particularly big ones, but they do come thick and fast.
Yeah.
But it's a great community event as well, so easy. And you did it with your friends.
Well, I did it with friends. I think also we drove over. So, you know, we went from Folkestone and just put the bikes on the roof. It is a slightly different proposition. I mean, it's not death-defying and all that, but just people know what it's like with bike boxes and sort of, you know, what you're going to find. It's quite funny. We landed at Lyon Airport and I going through these lads picking up their bikes, and they opened them immediately, which I thought, well, fair play, because I don't think I can face that. I need to just get to where I'm going, then I'll worry about that. And this bloke was like, oh, my bike's ruined and all this, and I paid for this bike box. And they were like, just, you know, a bounce, I think they call it, saying, yeah, you pay for the bike box, but you haven't actually clamped your bike in. But with your mates is a good one, I think.
Yeah. So don't want to give away the dramatic conclusion. And I mean, I'll say there were moments which matched the existential despair I felt when I was reading Cormac McCarthy's The Road. But how did the day go, James, in your opinion?
I mean, it was long. It was long. I finished. I didn't get swept up by the broom wagon, but basically I had, let's say, some stomach issues overnight, so I won't get into too much detail, you know, it's before 9 o'clock, but I felt rough, but I thought, well, I've got to go for it. Going at the Galibier, that was okay, because it was 8 o'clock in the morning, a bit cooler, and the gradient, what, 5.5% average or something, it was okay. Going down that descent, and I think Andy Hampston, who I interviewed before it, said probably one of the best descents he's ever done. And obviously Tom Pidcock showed off down there a few days later. but then you hit the feed zone and sun was coming up then, and this was just for the ascent of the Croix de Fer, and that was a different proposition. And I think I put in the book, it was like, it felt like a suffering of silence, just the joviality had disappeared, and then I just started to feel, because I was having some stomach issues, rougher and rougher. That's where my long day in and out of the saddle began.
Yeah. And you talked about a kind of psychological arc you go through, in that it's not just you who's experienced this. There's, you know, this is a thing. You talked about that arc of psychology. What, tell us a bit about.
Yeah, well, I got that from interviewing Mark Beaumont a couple of times, who's the Round the World record holder. He ride around the world, I think, in 79 days and riding 240 miles a day. And I think he was doing 4 hours on, certain amount of time off, 4 hours on. But he said, whether it was that or even like a, you know, say 40, 50 miles sportif, there's this psychological arc of, you start well and positive, as the finish line gets honed into view, you get that boost. There's that no man's land in the middle where you're a reasonable way from the start, but the finish line's still very far in the distance. You just have too much time to think about, you know, what lies ahead. And that's where the negative thoughts can seep in. And that's where I interviewed a chap called Noel Brick. He's a great name, lovely chap. He's a sports psychologist and reader at, I think it's Ulster University. And he was great, because he was like, I was feeling quite nervous by then. It was 1 or 2 weeks before. yeah, he's like Paul McKenna. He really, you know, even like techniques like chunking, which I'm sure you, a lot of your readers and listeners will be aware of, are just breaking it down, but just flipping everything of building on the experience, the stuff you've done. I spent time in Andorra Vineos at Altitude Camp, and that threw me a bit when I was speaking to Adrian Lopez, the trainer, and saying, well, this, we're going to have a mountain following Ben Tullett, and it's 30 kilometers. And said, what mountains are like this in Europe? And he said, well, the one that jumps out is the Galibier. I was like, oh, bugger, that's what I'm facing. So that threw me at the time, because like you said, I'm used to going up Cheddar Gorge. But he said, well, no, that's a positive experience. You're feeling that now. I mean, admittedly, a lot of these psychological techniques disappeared slightly the time I got to Haute d'Huez, because that was... I interviewed one lad and he said, by the time you get to Haute d'Huez, you're not going to want to be on the bike anymore. And he was absolutely right. And to be fair, I wasn't on the bike that much by then. It was a lot of on-off, push, ride, push.
Yeah. So apart from getting ill the night before, in terms of your preparation, what do you do differently next time? Presuming you're going to do this again, maybe I'm...
Absolutely. No, it darts all the way now, I think. I think in all honesty, so starting like the training program was great, but actually I think I was possibly a bit too tied with it at times. So I think I could have probably made it a bit more fun by doing my own training camps with my mates, you know, going off to the Breckens, which is just over, I live near Bristol now, so it's just over the Severn Bridge. So I think I could have added that variety. I probably needed to do more hills, to be honest. What I was following was probably more time and distance based rather than altitude based. And I've put that in the book. I think I'm sounding like George Best. Like I said, cutting the drinking for 9 weeks did lose a bit of weight. So I think if the go was big enough to have a real, you know, there's some nice non-alcoholic beers out there now, albeit they're sort of calorific.
Yeah. And lastly, you claim to be Devonian, but you refer to putting the cream on the jam on page 59, James. Explain.
Did I? I mean, we used to go to St. Ives all the time on holiday, so that's probably where it came from.
To explain to our listeners who are not from Devon and Cornwall that there's an ongoing debate about which goes first on the scone, the clotted cream or the jam. But James, really enjoyed reading the book. It made me laugh a lot. I was laughing with you, not at you, I should say. And really enjoyed it, learned a lot from it in terms of World Tour professionals and my day job, but also just enjoyed the humanity and just going on that journey with you. So thank you for that. Riding with Rocketmen by James Witt is available in all good bookshops now. Please support independent booksellers if you can. James, thank you very much for coming on Relo Conversations.
Thank you, Ed. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to Relo Conversations. Relo Conversations is made by the editorial staff of Relo magazine. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Relo and on Instagram at Relo magazine, or visit our website at relo.cc. This episode was produced by Amber Miller of Content is Queen.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.